The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Often something associated with New Year, at least in this country, is this notion of New Year's resolution. And often I think our relationship with that can be, you know, we'll make a resolution, we'll make a resolve to eat better or sit more or do something that would be healthy or good for us. And it often doesn't last. At least that was my relationship with New Year's resolutions for many years. But what I'd like to explore today is this question or topic of resolve or resolution. It is actually brought up in the teachings of the Buddha. In one place, in fact, he frames the path of our practice in terms of resolves, of making resolves. And in a way, if we think of our spiritual practice as a journey, these resolves lay out a map of our journey. And this, to me, connects with what a resolve or a resolution is. A resolution is very much a setting of a direction for our lives. It may be simple, as in a direction in terms of something we'd like to do, a simple thing for like a New Year's resolution, or it may be a bigger kind of direction or path. So a resolve or a resolution is about choosing or setting a path or a direction in our lives. And this, if we want to go on a journey, it's helpful to know what direction we're going. And so this, to me, connects this quality or this question of resolve with our journey, our spiritual path. And so a resolve is something, in a wholesome sense, a resolve is something that maybe we connect to out of a sense of compassion or care for ourselves or for others, in terms of this is a direction I'd like to head. This is the orientation I'd like to go. And that orientation is it's kind of like it charts a course, but that orientation then supports us making choices now. And so while the resolve or the orientation or the direction may seem like it's in the future, you know, something we'd like to get to or go towards, what it implies about our lives is that choices that come in alignment with that direction need to be made now. And so that's pointing us right into the present moment. And do our choices now come into alignment with our direction? Another word that can be useful here is aspiration. What is our aspiration? What is our movement? What is our direction for our lives? What do we hope for? What do we aspire for in our lives? And what choices do we need to make now that come in alignment with that? With that direction. And so the teaching on resolve in the Buddhist teaching, he points to four aspects, and in some ways it lays out a kind of a little map for us of a path for our spiritual practice. He says, there are these four resolves. And the word resolve in Pali is adhitana, that the Pali is adhitana. It's usually translated as resolve or determination. Can be translated as foundation. But the Pali word basically means something like to stand firmly, to place oneself firmly. Something like steadfast. And so there's a commitment aspect to resolve. That while it charts us a course or a direction, there's a way in which we have to remain steadfast in the moment, to connect to that, to not forget our resolves. I think this is a big part of what happens with New Year's resolutions, is that we forget. You know, our minds are so habitually oriented towards pleasure here and now, kind of a shortcut to getting what we want here and now. And when a determination or a resolve asks us to set aside what we want here and now for a future or a kind of an aim in the future, that can be challenging, especially when we forget about that direction. So this steadfastness about resolves is pointing us again into what are our choices, what's happening right now, how is it connected to that direction. And so the Buddha offered four resolves, four aspects of this direction. In terms of our spiritual life, one should not neglect wisdom. One should preserve the truth, cultivate relinquishment, and train for peace. So we might think of these as kind of priorities for our practice, aims or directions for our practice. Another thing I think that we, in terms of resolves, and it's important, I think, especially with respect to these kind of resolves, resolve not neglect wisdom, preserve the truth, cultivate relinquishment, and train for peace, that resolve is not simply about willpower. I think that's another area. And in fact, I just read an article in the New York Times about why New Year's resolutions tend to fail. They tend to fail, this psychologist said, because we're trying to use willpower to affect our resolutions. And he made the comment too in this. He says, well, you know, willpower will work for a little while, but we're basically trying to fight that really strong tendency to have something pleasant in the here and now. And so it's like, you know, we're trying to use willpower to force down that tendency. And this person in this article proposed that there are other qualities of mind that might support us to orient towards our resolves. And he pointed to self-respect, self-confidence, gratitude, and compassion as being supports for actually following through on our resolves. This is in alignment with what the Buddha points to. The Buddha uses some different ways of getting at this. But the very first resolve that the Buddha points to is a resolve for wisdom. And so this basically is asking us to look at what serves us in our lives. And this points right to that habit of mind that tends to want to get something that's pleasant in the moment. This habit of our system that basically has a kind of a very ingrained, although not hardwired, in a kind of ingrained sense that if I get what I want, then that's happiness will follow. And that is a very short-sighted form of happiness. And the Buddha acknowledged, actually, that happiness does come. There is a form of happiness. He called it a form of happiness comes when we get what we want. There's a form of pleasure, a form of a sense of almost relief or release or an aspect of delight in having something that we want, something that's pleasant. But he pointed to this as being the least form of happiness that's available to us as human beings. And that there are many better forms of happiness out there. And yet the habit of our mind is having gotten what we wanted and had a moment of happiness, over and over again we have had that happen in our lives. And basically, we think that that's as good as it gets. Maybe we recognize that a particular moment of getting something that we want doesn't last that long, but we do kind of believe that happiness would mean continually being able to get what I want, like stringing together moments of getting what I want, getting what I want, getting what I want, getting what I want. And that would be happiness. The Buddha actually points to, in one of the key wisdom teachings of the Buddha, so this is not neglecting wisdom, is beginning to recognize, and this is a hard one to recognize, that this habit of getting what we want and feeling that moment of happiness actually reinforces and sets us up in our lives for suffering. That is not so easy to see because of the way our minds work. When we want something, we get something that we want something. In that moment of wanting, we are experiencing a kind of a dissatisfaction, a kind of an offness. Things aren't okay. The moment wanting springs up, there's a feeling of not okayness. And yet, we don't really feel that not okayness because our minds are thinking about the having. If I can orient my actions and my activities so that I can get that thing, it's going to be great in that future. In that future moment, we find ourselves actually living in the fantasy of the having. And that obscures sometimes that feeling of dissatisfaction that comes in the wanting itself. Sometimes when we want something pleasant, we actually think it feels good because of the pleasure of the fantasy about the having. And so there's that pleasure of the fantasy about the having, and there's the missing of the feeling of the dissatisfaction. And then there's the getting, if we get the thing, if we navigate our lives and have that moment of happiness, we get that thing or that experience, or have people see us in a certain way, so many different ways we want things. Then we have the moment of getting something that we want in that moment. And there's the association in that moment with something pleasant. And there's some happiness that comes with that. There's also another form of happiness that is harder to see in that moment that is actually the stronger, I think, having seen it myself, that one of the things that happens in that moment when we get what we want is that for a few moments at least, that feeling of dissatisfaction goes away. The wanting goes away. And that feels pretty good. Actually, it feels really good to have wanting go away. And I'd say that that's probably the driver of our pattern and our habit. That in the moment when we get something that we want, not only do we get the pleasantness of the having, we get the pleasantness of the release of the unpleasant wanting. It's a powerful double hit. that drives this habitual pattern. And a lot of it happens, this habitual habit happens because we don't really see the wanting. And we don't actually take the time to be curious about what is the experience of wanting. When we're caught in wanting, and this is what I would say, not neglecting wisdom. This is one really key piece of wisdom the Buddha offers us. That when we're caught in that wanting, we are not able to see that the wanting itself is driving us towards something that is maybe not so helpful for us. The belief in the wanting, the kind of the orientation of the wanting, is if I get that thing, I'll be happy. That the wanting is... Sorry about that. Forgot to silence my own cell phone. The wanting... the belief in the wanting is, if I get what I want, I'll be happy. And wanting is not going to tell you. There's another piece about the wanting, that if we are curious about wanting itself, and with mindfulness, with investigation, watch the wanting. Maybe for something simple. Maybe for a simple wanting, having an extra piece of chocolate or... a large serving of dessert, something that we want that we can think of as optional. And if we watch the wanting there, when we don't follow through on the wanting, we'll feel the unpleasantness of the wanting. We'll feel it viscerally. It feels pretty uncomfortable. There's almost a magnetic pull towards that thing that we want. Feels really uncomfortable. And yet, it is just a phenomenon in our own minds. Wanting is just something our minds are doing. Conditions have come together to create this wanting, and our minds want. And it's a phenomenon that will be impermanent. And so we can watch this phenomenon. It's easiest to do with something simple that we understand, the first time at least, something that we understand is not like, a life or death matter. I explored this on one retreat doing walking meditation, where I really wanted to look at the people around me. And on this particular retreat, we were really encouraged to restrain our seeing, to not look at people. And so I was practicing that. And so I wasn't looking at people, but I was kind of using willpower to do this. I had this kind of the sense of resolve of, I am not going to do that. I am not going to look at people. I was kind of forcing myself not to look, blinders on. And it was kind of tense and tight. And people would be, doing walking meditation. It was particularly challenging because people are so close and it's so easy to just look over and see who's there. But I was not doing that, forcing myself to not look. I was not noticing that I wanted to look. And finally, after some time of this, I finally realized, wow, wanting is happening. I should be curious about the wanting. And so I began exploring the feeling of wanting and not just forcing myself to not look. And so this was a shift. This is a shift around resolve, to be curious about what's happening in the moment. And so I began being curious about the wanting and committed to not looking at people, but just seeing what happens to the wanting. And I got very familiar with the feeling of that pull, the feeling of the unpleasantness of the wanting. And I began actually noticing when the wanting began. It began as soon as somebody came into my field of vision. Boom, it arose. There it is, the wanting, feeling of that dissatisfaction, the sense of something being wrong, the sense of happiness coming from glancing up and looking at the person. And my realizing, well, it's kind of a happiness to look at somebody, but, you know, how much happiness is that? And so then, you know, kept watching it and you know, kept watching that pull, and then saw that when the person went out of my field of vision, they would, like, you know, walk in front of me, really tempting right there. The wanting got really strong when they were right in front of me, and then went into the building. The wanting vanished immediately when the stimulus that created the wanting was gone. The wanting vanished, and the feeling of the release from that wanting was like being released from a vice grip. That was a huge learning. That was a huge learning for me, the recognition that wanting is telling me you have to look at this person in order to have happiness. What wanting is not going to tell you is that if the wanting goes away, there won't be a problem. There won't be dissatisfaction when wanting goes away. And so this kind of wanting that I'm talking about here is a kind of a needy kind of wanting. There are forms of desire, forms of wanting. The word wanting is, you know, used so many different ways in English. This kind of neediness, or the word often used is craving, kind of sticky, a neediness, a feeling like if I don't get that thing, I'm not going to be okay. That's the kind of wanting, of desire that creates this tension inside. And we can look inside. Is this wanting, when we turn towards our wanting, does it create a tension in our hearts? Does it create a tightness, a constriction? Does it feel like a vice grip? If it feels like a vice grip, it's probably the kind of wanting that is creating this habit of suffering. And so that habit or pattern of getting what we want, actually that wanting, because we get what we want, because we have that moment of having that happiness of getting what we want and the release from that feeling of wanting, then our minds basically get into the pattern of searching for the next moment of happiness that can come, which comes from getting something that I want. And so basically our minds start wanting to want. We want to want something so that we can get something in order to be happy. This is the internet mind. You know, internet's such a powerful hook into this habit of mind. Sometimes I find myself sitting in front of that Google page wanting to think about something I want to search for. What do I want to know? So that I can have a moment of getting some information that I want to know. But I don't know what I want to know, so I want to know something. This is suffering, actually. When I notice this, I tried. It's like, oh, right, there's that wanting. Okay, you know, maybe I can just close that computer. So this habit of wanting doesn't tell us that if the wanting goes away, this suffering goes away. But I do want to point towards this sense of resolve, of direction, of aim, of aspiration. It is connected to a form of wanting. And yet when we feel into our hearts, when we want to aim towards qualities like compassion and generosity and wisdom and love, that quality of aiming in that direction doesn't have this constricted feeling. It has a feeling of openness and connection. And I think that's where we can check, where we can be curious. is the wanting that creates more suffering happening or not? You know, is the wanting that's happening here actually connecting us to our journey? Is it connecting us to wholesome qualities? Is it connecting us to love, compassion? Or is it squeezing us down? And so not neglecting wisdom as a resolve means remembering this wisdom around craving, the basic form of wisdom, the basic definition of wisdom in the Buddha's teaching is understanding the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering. The basic cause of suffering is craving. The release from that craving is freedom from suffering. And there's a path that can lead us there, the letting go. Understanding suffering, letting go of craving will lead us to this freedom from suffering. And yet it's not about becoming, it's not about like not acting, because this path is a path of action. It's a path of connecting to wholesomeness, of resolve, of the aim towards wisdom and truth, relinquishment and peace. So this is not a passiveness that we're looking at here. Another aspect of this wisdom that's pointed to in the teaching, the wisdom of our journey, the resolve towards wisdom, is that it's not just about understanding something intellectually. The word wisdom often we relate to in terms of information. And what I've offered here about wanting, this teaching about wanting, is very useful information that can help us. But it's not just the information that supports us. It's the curiosity to engage with that information, to look at our experience in the present moment. And this is another piece of the wisdom. The Buddha speaks about the experience of wisdom, experiencing the directness of our understanding. So that moment when I described feeling the wanting release and that being like being released from a vice grip, that was an experience of wisdom at work in the moment. The understanding that wanting causes suffering in the moment, and the release from that wanting in the moment is a release from that suffering. And so there is this experience, the experience, and that experience, the only place experience happens is now, in this moment. And so the Buddha offers us mindfulness to explore our experience from this perspective of what is it that's tightening the heart? And what is it that's opening the heart? That very simple check-in is actually one of the key ways that I explore my experience these days. Is the heart feeling open, connected, almost transparent? Or does the heart feel tight? When the heart feels tight, I get curious. What is that tightness? I don't try to use willpower to get rid of it. I explore it. That's what the Buddha pointed to around understanding suffering. As we explore it and understand it, we begin to see what's going on. And the wisdom of the patience of meeting that suffering begins to reveal kind of the structure of the suffering, the structure of that hardness, and begins to allow the heart to change course. Again, this is a long journey. It's a direction for our hearts. It's a direction for our hearts. The second resolve is the resolve for truthfulness, truth, preserving the truth. And some of this is about speaking truthfully. But I think it's a deeper, it's not just about not lying here. This preserving the truth is really about a deep kind of honesty with ourselves. When we are experiencing that tightness and that tension and are motivated by greed, aversion, confusion, being truthful about that. That truthfulness about that allows a different relationship to it, creates a kind of container in which that can be seen and known, in which the heart can begin. It's like when we turn towards that constricted heart with curiosity, with kindness and compassion, it creates like a bigger container in which our resolve to connect to our direction can be maintained. And so we open, it creates a container in which that pain, that inner pain can be felt and known and seen. The wisdom of that begins to transform it. And so kind of an inner truthfulness, an inner honesty about how are we acting? What are our motivations? And the Buddha also points to a simple aspect of preserving the truth that is also really important, I think. It helps us to recognize how often we assume that what we believe is truth. The Buddha pointed to, in one teaching, somebody is asking the Buddha, how does one preserve the truth? And the Buddha responds, if one has faith in something, one says, my faith is thus. This is what I have faith in. One doesn't say, this is what is true. And inwardly as well, this points to recognizing when we are acting or motivated out of belief that we are assuming is truth. This happens so much. So much of how we navigate our lives is around what we believe. And beliefs come into being from faith. The Buddha had five things. He says, if a person approves of something, one says, one preserves the truth by saying, I approve of this, but not saying, this is what's true. If one receives information from elsewhere that one believes, one says, I received this information from elsewhere. This is what I am believing. If one reaches a conclusion based on one's own reasoning, one says, I reached this conclusion, not this alone is true. And he distinguishes between reaching a conclusion based on reasoning and gaining acceptance of a view based on reflection. I think maybe one has more logic in it and the other maybe more emotion. I don't know quite the difference between those two. But whatever our beliefs are and however they have been arrived at, we recognize them as belief. And to ourselves, we need to have some honesty. This is, my belief is thus. Not this is truth, but my belief is thus. And, you know, this can help us in relationship across our divides in community and in the political spectrum. This can support us to acknowledge this is what I believe. This is why I believe it, but this is what I believe. Not this is right, that is wrong. This is the belief. And it can also help us internally to acknowledge what our beliefs are. We have many beliefs about who we are, what we're capable of, that limit us, I myself did not know for a long time. I had a belief that I was a failure, that I was no good, that I was unworthy. Kind of a self-hatred coming from that belief somehow in my unworthiness. And as I began practicing, I began recognizing, oh, this is a belief. The mind makes a statement, kind of a subtle undercurrent statement. You're no good. You're a failure. And when that's not seen as being a belief, the mind simply believes it as truth. I am a failure. I am no good. Not believing is happening. So this is actually an important piece in our practice as well, this exploration around belief and acknowledging it as belief, looking at view, understanding what views we are operating from. This can support us internally and externally in our relationships to ourselves and our relationships to others. We may come upon beliefs and views inside. This can be very painful, actually. When I came upon that belief, I was kind of shocked because I thought of myself as being a very competent, very capable person. And to see the underlying motivation for that competence was a belief in my unworthiness was kind of a shock. Was that was what had motivated me to try so hard, was this belief that I was not worthy. And so there's this interesting dynamic between this identity of being a competent person and this believing I was a failure. So this, internally, we can begin to see beliefs that we're kind of shocked about. Externally, we can see beliefs that we're kind of shocked about. We can recognize perhaps that we have views around racism that don't align with our kind of rational view of ourselves. That we might have an inner sense of a hit of fear when seeing someone of a different race that we don't know, that in a particular situation there might be that inner hit of fear that's based in this difference, this othering, and a belief somehow that other is bad. And so the beliefs that we can uncover internally can be very painful to witness. And there can be a tendency when we see beliefs in there, when we actually begin to recognize some of the beliefs, the views that have been motivating us, that our system has been taking as truth, it can be a tendency to repress those, to say, I don't believe that. And there's a way in which we don't believe it. But there's a kind of a deeper kind of underlying, like when I saw the you're no good. It's like, well, I don't really believe that. But the piece of me is like, no, you believe this. You know, underneath, very deeply conditioned underneath was that strong belief. And so the practice here around truth is beginning to acknowledge these beliefs. Not to try to repress them, but also when they are seen as belief, there's the opportunity to hold it in a different way. Because when belief isn't seen, it is simply acted on as truth. But when it is seen, there's an opportunity to engage either with external beliefs about others or internal beliefs about ourselves, an opportunity to engage in a different way. To not perhaps act automatically based on that belief, but choose a different relationship to that. And so this exploration around truth is a good piece of this, is beginning to be really honest with ourselves about what our beliefs are, And recognizing, as the Buddha says, my belief is thus. And having the space to recognize, is this a belief that is in alignment with my direction? And if it is not a belief that's in alignment with my direction, then again, the medicine is around curiosity. Oh, what does it feel to hold this belief? Holding the belief of you're a failure, pretty tight, pretty constricted, pretty painful. The heart can at times be big enough to know that, to be seen, to love the entirety of ourselves. A big piece, I think, a big piece of this mindfulness practice is about loving ourselves. No part left out. And becoming healed. Becoming transformed through that seeing, through that loving. When we want to be loved externally, when we want somebody to love us, so often we wish for some kind of unconditional love, some kind of people to see us completely, fully through just who we are and not reject any part of us. And yet the likelihood of somebody else being able to do that for us. There are some beings out there, I've heard, who can do that. The Dalai Lama has that kind of quality. Just so much loving whoever he comes in contact with, that it feels, it transforms us to experience that kind of quality. And we can also see ourselves more fully, more deeply than anybody else can, through a kind of compassionate, loving awareness. And that can transform us. So truth, preserving the truth, recognizing what we believe, acknowledging it as belief. And another aspect of truth is that we begin to recognize, this connects to the wisdom piece, we begin to recognize that whatever is happening in our experience has a quality of being impermanent. This is truth. The impermanent nature of experience is truth, and it is staring us in the face. We tend to avoid it, not see it, even around as simple of a truth as the fact that we are going to die. We are going to die, we don't know when. Might be this day, this moment. And to me, that reflection actually supports a connection with my resolve. The other day, I was a little bit disconnected from my experience, and I was picking up some vitamins to take in the morning, and the vitamins that I'm taking are calcium, and they're kind of big pills, and I've had some trouble with swallowing them in the past. And as I picked it up, there was a recollection or the recognition. This choice to swallow this pill may be my last act. I'm going to choose to do this, and yet it may be the last thing I do. Can I be here for it? That actually had the benefit of helping me to swallow it more carefully so that I didn't choke. And yet it also really brought me right into the present moment. So this acknowledgement of impermanence, really important aspect of truth, of aligning ourselves with this truth, that everything we experience is impermanent. Our lives are impermanent. Cultivating relinquishment, the third resolve. This one may be the place where we get a little stuck, because the word relinquishment sounds like I want to let go of something. And often when we think of letting go of things, you know, renunciation, we think about letting go of things that we want. But what we can think about with relinquishment, actually what we're relinquishing is those things, those states of mind that keep us from peace. We relinquish. The relinquishment is about relinquishing our habits of greed, aversion, and delusion. This relinquishing, sometimes the word used is abandon. One abandons greed, one abandons aversion, one abandons delusion. And abandoning sounds like an active thing, that we can just like put it down and walk away from it. That's kind of the word abandonment, that, you know, we think about, put something down and walk away from it. But relinquishment and abandonment in this practice, sometimes there can be an active sense of abandoning or letting go of something that we see as being painful. Like one day I was doing dishes and recognized that I was somewhat impatient in the dishwashing. And as I was reflecting on that, as I noticed that impatience, I realized, wow, you know, this moment, again, that recollection of this moment might be my last, this may be my last day on earth. Is impatience how I want to be living my life? And that supported me, that recollection, remembering that of impermanence helped me to kind of consciously let go of that impatience and just be with the dishwashing. So sometimes with abandoning or relinquishing it, it can be a kind of active choice. We can see something that our mind is engaged in, a habit, a pattern, and recognize, yeah, I don't need to go that. I can replace it or shift to something else. I can shift to cultivating love or kindness or care or compassion. And sometimes we can do that. But there's a lot of times in our practice that the best we can do is be aware of whatever it is that we're holding on to. So sometimes it might be, like with the wanting example, watching the wanting, knowing the wanting is there. This is an act, in a way, an act of relinquishment. It's relinquishing our habitual relationship with wanting in order to be with it. This is a huge act of relinquishment. Can we be curious about our suffering, our struggles, our patterns, our greed, our aversion, our confusion? Can we be curious about them? Relinquishing the habit or the tendency behind that pattern. And so perhaps we feel into anger and relinquishing acting on anger. But it doesn't mean that we repress the anger. So this path the Buddha talked about is a middle path. This is one way it can be seen as a middle path. Something like anger arises. We explore the relinquishment of acting on the anger and feeling into it. That act of feeling into, what is this experience of anger? That is a form of relinquishment. And it's a transforming form of relinquishment. It allows us to neither repress the anger nor express it. And to feel into it, we begin to understand the pain of the anger itself, or the pain of the wanting itself, or the pain of the confusion or the pain of the impatience itself. And with that understanding, the mind begins to release it, to shift around it. In that example of the wanting, the mind let go of the wanting. when the conditions changed. I didn't have to do that. It abandoned itself when the conditions changed, and I witnessed that abandonment. So this is a lot of how our relinquishing goes, is being curious about the tightness in our hearts, being curious about that. And the final resolve, train for peace. The definition of peace that the Buddha offers is the pacification of greed, aversion, and delusion. So it sounds a little circular. And yet, just kind of feel into it for a moment. If there weren't the constriction of wanting things to be other than they are, or wanting to get rid of something, how would the heart be? And this heart that is open, connected, at ease, not needing things to be different than what is true, not needing for things to be permanent when they're not permanent, not needing for things to be reliable when they're not reliable. Again, that commitment to truth, and that opening to this is things as they are, supports a relinquishment which allows us to actually experience maybe at times moments of peace. And then we begin to see that this the little tastes we get, the little tastes of peace, that becomes like our North Star, becomes our guide, our direction. And we can feel this. As I said earlier, you know, the constriction of greed, aversion, and delusion, or the release, the open-heartedness of love and compassion, ease of heart. In the moment, that is kind of feedback to let us know when we're feeling that ease in the heart. That's feedback to let us know we're on the path. We're heading in the direction of our aspiration. And something else I find about this training for peace. Peace is said, you know, it's said to be the aim. You know, this pacification of greed, aversion, and delusion. This is also understood as being the third noble truth, the goal of our spiritual practice. Freedom from greed, aversion, and delusion. To me, I love this because it leaves a lot of room for activity. I mean, I can potentially imagine what it might be like to live in this world without the constricted heart, acting and caring and loving and being compassionate. I can imagine that. And I can imagine it partly because I felt at times this heart that is unconstricted. And so there's not such a difference in a way between the goal of the path and walking the path. As we walk the path, we may experience little moments of this peace or understand the possibility for that. And we can actually train in this. As the Buddha says, we train for peace. It's possible, potentially, at times to act peacefully, even if we're not feeling it. This is kind of that middle range again. You know, when I talked about acknowledging, yes, anger is arising, not repressing the anger and not expressing it, one can fully know there is anger present, and see. And what would a peaceful person do right now? How might a peaceful person act? Fully not repressing that anger, but acting peacefully. That has a powerful impact on the heart, because it's, in a way, it's harnessing the power of intention. Another word that's connected in a way with resolve, the power of intention towards something, the power of intention towards peace, knowing the anger and yet acting with the intention towards peace. That intention is like planting seeds in our hearts that will grow in our lives as peace. And so there's not that much of a difference in a way between, I would say, the path of our practice reflects the aim of our practice. That when we feel challenge and struggle in our hearts, we need to hold it with some peace as much as we can, rather than meeting it with anger and hatred. The path reflects the goal. So it's time to stop. Thank you for your attention.